Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the first CELS lunchtime seminar of the academic year. As some of you know already, we have these seminars every Wednesday lunchtime through the Michaelmas term and the Lent term. And I'm pleased to see so many of you here today. It's my great pleasure to welcome as the first speaker of our 2011-2012 series, Professor Sinden, a Dutch colleague who was until recently at the University of Tilburg, but is now at the University of Utrecht. The University of Utrecht is one of the universities with which Cambridge Law Faculty has friendly links in the form of the Erasmus programme. Professor Sinden has made a reputation for herself writing about, in particular, matters of soft law, which is a topic she discovered before anybody else had even heard of it, I believe. I'm not sure whether your talk today has anything to do with soft law.
Slightly, in the end, I think it will touch somewhere on soft law.
But I won't take up any more of her time, and over to you, Professor Sinden.
Thank you very much, and thank you. Thank the Center for European Policy Studies in the first place for inviting me to come and speak to you today. I deliberately actually decided to talk on a different subject than the one I think indeed I might be most known for. I will be talking about the positioning of the citizen in EU law, how coherent is the Union's approach, and I chose that topic because it's linked very much to the research program Utrecht University, the Faculty of Law just started this year. And since I indeed moved from Tilburg to Utrecht University, I will be participating and contributing to that research program. It's called The Citizen in the Multiple Legal Order, and I thought, well, this is a good occasion actually to present some thoughts on this subject to you and also to get some feedback and comments on it from you. So there's also, of course, always a little bit tricky to present something you're not engaged in for a very long time as yet, but on the other hand, I think the position of the citizen in EU law is a topic that, particularly in these times, draws a lot of attention, or should draw perhaps more attention than it actually does. So this is why I chose this topic. So why is it relevant? Let me first say something on this issue. Why should we talk about the positioning of the citizen in EU law and the coherency of the approach of the Union towards the citizen? I think, first of all, that is relevant because we could say that there is a question of a changing paradigm of the European integration process. I think for a long time, European integration process was very much economic purpose oriented. But increasingly, we can say with the different treaty amendments, the Union, the integration process is becoming more value-based, and I will say more about this issue later on. And I think this is, of course, to be to the benefit of the citizen. And the emphasis, the treaties, etc., are placing on the Union's values in many different ways is ultimately to be to the benefit of us, the citizens in the European Union. And secondly, you could also say, well, the Union itself is making that link in the treaties, and I think we can find a very explicit reference to this in the preamble of the Charter of Fundamental Rights, where it says explicitly that the Union places the individual at the heart of its activities, and especially by establishing the citizenship of the Union and by creating an area of freedom, security and justice. So clearly, whatever the Union does should be to the benefit of the citizen. So it's a very ambitious, good starting point, of course. But the question is, of course, also how does this effectively translate in the union's law and policies? And obviously, that is too broad of a question to tackle here, because it's also a question that you should be considering at different policy levels or different sectors. But what I will be doing today is, in fact, pleading to use the notion of coherence as a lens to look at this question, to research this issue. Because I think it will, or it enables us, this notion to assess the extent to which the union realizes effectively protection of citizens and realizing the goals it sets itself with a view to benefiting the European citizen. I think we can consider that question through the notion of coherence. It allows for cross-sectoral analysis, you could say, for a more comprehensive analysis of this particular issue. So let us look first to, well, the first element in the title of my contribution, the positioning of the EU citizen, and then in particular how the EU citizen is positioned post-Lisbon, since the entry into force of the Lisbon Treaty. I use the term positioning deliberately, but as you well have noticed, I'm not a native speaker in English, and you might perhaps question the use of that term from the perspective of an English native speaker, but what I...
It's perfect.
It's perfect? Okay, because I don't want to talk about the position of the EU citizen in the sense that it would mean or perhaps convey the idea we're only talking about the legal position of the citizen, but I want to talk about the way in which the treaties kind of position the EU citizen in the integration process. So if you say it's... Okay, thank you, because I was a little bit worried about that, whether it would really have the nuance, same nuance in English than it has, I think, in Dutch. What I think is important when we look at the way in which the treaties position the citizen, and here I should still say the EU citizen, because this is what the treaties primarily focus on. And there again I have a language issue, because I use the term from, or I want to emphasize the shift from what I call a singular to a double positioning of the EU citizen. And what do I mean by this? I think if we look at the way in which the original EEC treaty, but also the Single European Act, positioned the EU citizen, it was still very much as a bearer of rights, and in particular, economic rights, be in as market participants, be it as a worker, a trader, entrepreneur, self-employed, a consumer. But clearly the focus was on this capacity of citizens in the European Union. We can say gradually, with the Treaty of Maastricht, the Treaty of Amsterdam and Nice, we can see a move towards also giving economically non-active citizens certain rights, such as students, for instance, in the early directives, specific directives were adopted to give them also certain free movement rights. And we can also say there is a gradual shift from economic to social and also to fundamental rights up until the Treaty of Lisbon. The Treaty of Maastricht, as we have seen, the introduction of the Union citizenship, but there still we can say, well, it introduced indeed another kind of rights, but political rights, but it still was a very much a rights-based approach towards union citizenship, even though they were extended with every treaty amendment. If we look at the positioning of the EU citizenship since the entry into force of the Treaty of Lisbon, we can say, well, there is still much emphasis and confirmation, in fact, of the EU citizen as a bearer of rights. There's more emphasis even on protection of human and fundamental rights in those in that treaty. But at the same time, we can also say the Treaty of Lisbon has positioned the EU citizen as a political actor. And we will talk about this more in detail later on, but there are these provisions in the Treaty of Lisbon, or introduced by the Treaty of Lisbon, on participatory and direct democracy. So in that sense, we could say, well, this question of a double positioning of the EU citizen. To explain this a little bit further, I think this positioning as a bearer of rights, we can say, well, how is this being confirmed by the Treaty of Lisbon? You could say there are a number of substantive principles or standards, because it's questionable whether you could all label them as principles, but it's clear that we find far more confirmation in the new EU treaty and the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union of, well, what the Union actually is aiming for in the end. How it should look like from a substantive view. What are really the material goals to achieve? And we can find it in different provisions of the EU treaty, and in particular Article 2 of the Union Treaty, where the common values and foundations are being mentioned. And we can see there explicit reference to respect for human rights or human dignity, freedom, democracy, equality, rule of law, respect of human rights, and also protection of minorities, which was one specifically added by the Treaty of Lisbon in addition to what was already in the old EU treaty. But we see also reference to the common characteristics of society in Article 2 of the Union Treaty. Pluralism is one of those characteristics, non-discrimination, tolerance, justice, solidarity, which is obviously a very important element in the discussion now surrounding the euro crisis, and also equality of women and men. And then the aims and goals, they are in Article 3 of the Union Treaty. We can see a very interesting development here if you would compare it to the old EEC treaty, and you would see that it has become, the goals and aims of the Union have become far more social. High level of unemployment, combat social exclusion, social progress, sustainable development, solidarity, equality, protection of the rights of the child, all these elements, we could say, have been made far more explicit by the Treaty of Lisbon than they were in the old version of the treaties. So if we look then at the positioning as a political actor by the Treaty of Lisbon, we could say the treaty contains also a number of institutional principles or standards, which you could also label them to a certain extent as principles of good administration or good governance, but those are to regulate or to condition the Union's behavior, in fact, in realizing the goals and values and foundations it is striving after. And here we see also with the entry into force of the Lisbon Treaty that more of such principles are being made explicit in the treaty text. And we know, of course, all the principle of conferral, subsidiarity, and proportionality, which were already there for a long time. But we can also see now in Article 9 of the Union Treaty, principle of equality. But here we see the principle of equality emerging in a different kind of meaning. We all know principle of non-discrimination on the grounds of nationality and sex, etc., as a kind of subjective right for people. Here we see the principle of equality being formulated as a principle of good administration, you could say, but also in a political meaning, because it stipulates that people, citizens, have to be treated in an equal way by the institutions of the European Union. So it's being framed in a different meaning. And then Article 11 relates to or stipulates citizen participation. And where we saw still in the Constitutional Treaty for Europe, the terms participatory and direct democracy explicitly used, those terms have been removed from Title II and from this provision, but in terms of contents, they are still formulated in the same way. And we will see later on what is interesting about that formulation. And here we can say, well, there are two dimensions to this provision. It's not only to guide the union's institutions' behavior, that in the sense that, you know, they have to make sure that they involve citizens in the decision-making process as a norm of good administration, but at the same time, it has also the meaning, of course, or the link to substantive goal, you could say, of realizing democracy in the EU. One of the fundamental values should also lead to democratic legitimacy. So there is a double connotation, you could say, to this provision. And then, interestingly, we also find provisions regarding coherence, consistency, effectiveness, and continuity in the treaty. And we will also be looking at those more in detail. But this is also, at least as far as I'm aware, fairly new. This is, I don't think you could find it in the old version of the treaties, these references. And you could say, well, they were already part, to some extent, of EU law, but now they have been formulated in an explicit way in the treaty text itself. And also the principle of openness and transparency, if you compare it to the old version in the treaties, it has been turned into a more kind of fundamental principle of good administration, and it's formulated in a broader meaning than it was in the old version. You could say, and this is also something I will be stressing later on, that by making those substantive principles and standards and goals and the institutional principles and standards more explicit in the treaty text itself is something that contributes already to coherence of EU law. Okay? Because it's kind of more clear what you should assess the European integration process by, whether it's actually, it's more easy to kind of assess whether it's realizing its aims if it's clear what those aims exactly are and what the values and foundations exactly are. But this is something I will be addressing later on as well. Let us first look at the way in which coherence is framed in the treaties. And first of all, I think we find it in the preamble of the Treaty of Lisbon itself. It's the very first consideration of the preamble, which says, desiring to complete the process started by the Treaty of Amsterdam and by the Treaty of Nice with a view to enhancing the efficiency and democratic legitimacy of the Union and to improving the coherence of its action. So it was part creating or bringing about improving coherence of the Union's action, whatever that means, policies, law, everything, I think, was really at the outset of the whole institutional reform. Then we find it also in Article 11, paragraph 3 of the Union Treaty, where it says that the European Commission shall carry out broad consultations with parties concerned in order to ensure that the Union's actions are coherent and transparent. So there is a link made there with citizen participation and the notion of coherency. Then Article 13 of the EU Treaty, where it doesn't speak about coherence, But it speaks about consistency, and one of the questions, of course, already emerging, well, is that the same? Huh? Should we understand that in the same way? Is it the same notion, or does it refer to something else, perhaps? But anyhow, the union is to ensure an institutional framework that ensures also consistency, effectiveness, and continuity of its policies and actions. And then Article 7 of the functioning treaty states, well, the union shall ensure consistency between its policies and activities and taking all of its objectives into account, and also the principle of conferred powers. So you can see, well, we have at least those four provisions. There is also one related to the external policies, which I left out here, but I think you can see already by those four provisions that the notions are not completely the same ones, and they are also the formulations are also different. And the question is, well, what could that possibly mean, and how are we to understand the meaning and function of coherence as it is being used in these provisions? Well, looking here at the literature, and there has been a recent paper published by Den Hertog and Strauss, which actually looked a little bit into, or digged into, the meaning of coherence, and, you know, also going into, well, the ambiguities that it actually presents in many ways, especially if you connect it to notions such as consistency. And I think they kind of make a convincing argument to say, well, consistency is slightly different from coherence, and we should look at coherence in the sense that it's in fact a broader notion. We have inconsistency being only a part of coherence. And they say, well, coherence or consistency, well, it's the absence of contradictions within and between individual policies. If that is the case, well, those policies are consistent. But coherence means more than just the absence of contradictions. Coherence would mean that there is also some kind of movement towards the achievement of the common objectives. That in the end, whatever you are doing with the policy you're developing, that it leads also to realization of the overarching goals and objectives. So it involves more of an effort, also a more positive effort, you could say, to actually realize that. And I think, well, this is the way indeed to look at it, and not all consistent policies are by definition coherent, I would say. Coherence, we can also look at this notion, well, there are different levels to be distinguished, and a common distinction that is also made in the literature is between internal coherence, horizontal coherence, and vertical coherence. And internal coherence meaning that a policy is consistent in itself. An individual policy sphere must show internal coherence, and you could say in terms of goal setting and in implementation, and in realizing the goals of that specific policy sphere. Horizontal coherence would refer to coherence between policies, between individual policies of the overall system, you could say. And if you actually go back, I think, to these two provisions, you could argue, well, the first one seems to allude more to internal policies, at least if you would take it, read it in a more literal way, whereas the second one would more really refer to horizontal coherence. Vertical coherence means actually coherence between the union policies and the policies on the national level, the member states' policy in the same policy field. Here we could say, well, we can use, or we can see that coherence functions both as an instrumental tool and an assessment tool. instrumental or functional in a way that it helps to realize common objectives. Huh? It's really formulated in a way, in the understanding of Den Hertog and Strauss, that it really contributes to realizing the overall common objectives. At the same time, you could also say, well, it's an assessment tool because it allows us this notion to test policy outcomes by. Huh? So in that sense, you could say we cannot use it in a different way. Huh? It allows us to measure to a certain extent to whether the union actually is capable of realizing the goals it's setting itself. So there is a double function, you could say, of this notion. Well, why is coherence so relevant also from a citizen's perspective? I think here with the euro crisis actually provides us with a good example because it shows us that, well, whenever policies are not coherent, and here we would say, well, the way in which the economic and monetary union has been, and especially the introduction of the euro has been framed, at least I think what the current situation shows us, that while the goals have been set very high, they were very ambitious with the introduction of the euro, but on the level of implementation and enforcement, you could say there is some kind of a discrepancy. Huh? So they are not being coherently or not sufficiently geared to one another. Shows us that it can have quite detrimental consequences for citizens on all different kinds of levels, financially, for taxpayers, obviously, but people also lose employment as a result, or lose their houses because they can't pay for the mortgage anymore. So you could say there are all kinds of consequences on a personal level. But in a legal respect, of course, you could also say incoherence leads to legal uncertainty in many respects. Because if the law is being framed in an ambiguous way, if the means to realize policy goals are not sufficient, it can all create all kinds of uncertainty on the level of individual rights protection and the like. So I think that is an important point to point out. So there is really on the level of citizens' protection, it can have all kinds of consequences. At the same time, it can also have very far-reaching consequences for the system as such, and I think this is also what we are witnessing with the euro crisis, that it leads to people's distrust in the overall legal and political system. So it's very important also for the political acceptance of the European integration process to have coherent policies. And we have heard, I think, various voices in the media. I think Joschka Fischer, for instance, and also Barroso and others have been saying, well, if this is continuing like this, we might have the situation that the whole integration process is being affected and might actually collapse. So the effects can be very detrimental. And coherence, I think, plays an important, incoherence plays an important role in this regard. I have to watch the time and leave time for discussion. So let me go quickly to the coherence consistency building mechanisms, because I think that is also important from a legal point of view. How can coherence and consistency actually be brought about or be improved? Well, it's interesting to go back to the Commission's white paper from 2001. You find a number of more kind of policy-oriented tools to build or reinforce or restore coherence, refocus policy, make more explicit what your objectives are, and I think that is what we have seen with the Treaty of Lisbon. Establish cross-cutting policy agendas. This is also something we are witnessing, I think, in the Commission's practice. Think of the Europe 2020 strategy, for instance, or think of documents the Commission has published on a renewed internal market linked, in fact, to citizenship. They also mention long-term thinking and leadership, and I think this is exactly what we are missing at this point, and you can see the detrimental effects on coherence. From a legal point of view, Marisa Cremona has identified a number of rules that are important to build coherence, and she has mentioned rules of hierarchy, rules of delimitation, rules of cooperation and complementarity. And here, of course, you can think rules of hierarchy relating to, for instance, the primacy of European law, rules of delimitation, where we have rules like, or principles like principle of conferral and subsidiarity and proportionality, rules of cooperation and complementarity, we can think of the principle of sincere cooperation. Those are all kind of rules and principles that in the end might help build coherence. And also rules of substantive guidance have been mentioned explicitly by Den Hertog and Strauss, and that connects in fact to the first observation I made. Well, where the Treaty of Lisbon has made substantive and institutional principles more explicit, you could say, well, that such rules of guidance have been also improved or enhanced. Well, let us then briefly look at, well, the political positioning of the EU citizen and the issue of coherence, and that will be my final point to make, just to leave enough time for discussion. But here it's interesting, I hope you will be able to see this actually with the colors I used. It's interesting when you read this Article 11 in the title, which is called explicitly the title on democratic principles, you find three paragraphs which all relate to the involvement of third actors, civil society, citizens in the decision, in the union's decision-making process. But if you start kind of reading it very carefully, you really start wondering, well, what kind of vision is really underlying this provision, because it mentions, for instance, here the institutions, well, should get into kind of touch with the citizen, but then you can already ask yourself, well, would, for instance, the Court of Justice be also be addressed by this provision? Well, you know, could be. And in the second one, it's also the institutions that should engage in a dialogue with representative associations and civil society, but then we see slightly different actors mentioned in the second paragraph. The representative associations are in the first one, but civil society is not, citizens are. So what is, why are there these differences? Does it mean anything, or does it mean that there are deliberate distinctions made or not? And the third one, we see, it's the European Commission that should consult, so there is apparently not an obligation imposed on the other institutions like the European Parliament to engage in broad consultations with parties concerned, which one could also imagine, of course. And here we see parties concerned are mentioned and not civil society and citizens as such. So when we talk about coherence and also consistency, internal consistency, I think this provision is already problematic. If you would look at it from, you know, the coherence building mechanisms we just talked about, then you could say, well, what kind of rules does this provision kind of represent? You could say, well, I can see a rule of cooperation and complementarity in here, especially in the third one, because it is meant to enhance coherence by actually bringing the Commission and parties concerned together. Somehow, you know, they should be in touch with each other, should cooperate to kind of improve the coherence of EU law, and the parties concerned apparently have been given a role in this respect as well. You could also say, well, there's also a rule of substantive guidance to be discerned in this provision, because it is in a title on democratic principles. So we should understand that creating this whole process in the end also enhances democracy. so that it really meets the common overall objectives of the EU. Article or paragraph 4 of Article 11 is the European Citizens Initiative, and here we can say, well, it is already framed differently in the sense that there was an obligation here imposed, in fact, on the union institutions to come up with a piece of regulation to actually set the conditions for the organization of such European Citizens Initiative. So it's already, in that sense, the intention to actually put it in a harder framework than is the case with the framework in the first three paragraphs of Article 11. So if we are, I have to say something still briefly on what vision is underlying this Title 2 and what distinction might we see between the first three paragraphs and the fourth one. It's interesting to look at the literature here, some comments that have been made, well, actually criticizing, I would say, very much the lack of coherence and of vision underlying Title II. But I would say the major tension we find expressed in this title, in particular in Article 11, is, well, you could say, well, there is a clear tension between enhancing the effectiveness of EU law and enhancing democratic legitimacy. Because I would say if you look at the first three paragraphs of Article 11, they are in fact still very much geared towards maintaining flexibility for the union institutions. There is little to no real citizen empowerment you can find in those paragraphs. There is no obligation, in fact, to create some kind of hard legal framework to also build a certain or offer a certain citizen empowerment, whereas this is different for paragraph 4, where you could say, well, there we could say, and also looking at the contents of this newly established regulation, in fact, it does lead to a certain citizen empowerment. So for the first three paragraphs, I would say, well, effectiveness and flexibility in particular for the union institution has been given priority. I think with the new regulation established on the European Citizens Initiative, actually the European Parliament managed to really also build in certain elements in that regulation that do empower citizens to a certain extent. My very last comment, because I just can't leave this out, because I think it's a very crucial issue when we talk about coherence. When we talk about positioning of the citizen in EU law, well, where does this all leave the non-EU citizen that has been living in the European Union for a long time, perhaps was born in the European Union or has in any other way a close tie with a EU country? We can see, well, the non-EU citizens are excluded from many rights the EU has created. This is also the case, for instance, for the European Citizens Initiative now. So you could say it is also being excluded from the political process to quite some extent. And then you would say, well, to some extent, that is a consistent policy of the EU, to say, well, the non-EU citizen is in fact excluded from EU citizenship and doesn't really, you know, have a number of rights. But in the end, you could say, well, does that really lead to a coherent policy in terms of, well, the achievement of the common values and foundations the EU is striving after? Right? We started out with equality, etc. So I think there's really a tension here, a contradiction. The more the EU is moving towards realizing its values, etc., the more, in fact, you could say, the more serious the consequences are for the non-EU citizens that are not part of this. So.
Thank you.
I'm sorry I didn't manage to keep it to 25 and plus 35 minutes.
Yes. Very well. Thank you very much for the most interesting talk put over in perfect English and most thought-provoking. We have time for a little discussion before we have to leave. Professor Sendon says she'll be happy to attempt to answer questions. Who would like to ask a question or make a comment?